Like we always do with this time. I go for mine, I get to shine. Now throw your hands up in the sky.
Oh, we missed you so much. Welcome back. National Football Authority Radio is back on the internet, airwaves, however you broadcast across the internet. We are so pleased to be back here. It's been a hiatus of 2 weeks. We apologize. The NFL hitting free agency, ending this lockout has been absolutely insane. There has been so many articles going up on nationalfootballauthority.com that we frankly haven't had time to get the radio up. But you know what? We're going to make it up to you. And I am your host. I am Matt Baxendale. Those of you who know me from the college football previews from 790 The Zone in Atlanta, Georgia, and of course with Bucknuts.com and nationalfootballauthority.com. And I got great news for you. To make it up to you, we are going to be starting two shows a week. That's right. We're going to have the NFA Radio, NFL Writers Roundtable, starting every Wednesday. We're going to be having some of the biggest names in the world of NFL football writing coming on. I'll give you a little preview of that tonight. We're going to have on Bearheiser. He's the NationalFootballAuthority.com editor-in-chief of the NFL. We're bringing on Russell Baxter. He's the football guru. And on top of that, we're bringing in Robert Neely, who is the man with the plan at the Carolina Panthers camp. These are three of the best people out there covering NFL football. You will not want to miss it. And tonight, we're going to give you a quick preview of it so you can know what you can have coming up each and every Wednesday. So check it out. The NFA Radio, NFL Writers Roundtable, it's coming up soon. Also on tonight's show, we're bringing back Nate Custer. Bax and Nate on college football. We have been dropping so many college football previews. It's ridiculous. We have previewed all the way up through the non-automatic qualifying conferences. And this week, it's Notre Dame. Came out on Monday. We have the Atlantic Coast Conference coming out. And we got the rest of the BCS automatic qualifying leagues coming up in the next few weeks. You won't want to miss it. But as always, we start every show off with one topic off the top of my head. But since we've been gone the last 2 weeks, I'll save it for next week. Let's get straight to the interviews, and let's go straight to the NFA Radio NFL Writers Roundtable. It was an evening I shared with the sun. And welcome back to National Football Authority Radio. And finally, the long, horrible lockout has come to a conclusion. We can finally start talking about actual football teams, games on the field in the NFL, which brings us to our first ever Writers Roundtable for the National Football League. We're joined by three of NationalFootballAuthority.com's best writers on the NFL. We've got Bearheiser. He's the NFL editor-in-chief. We have Russell Baxter with us. He's a pro football guru. And we also have Robert Neely with us, and he is the man from football relativity. And gentlemen, it has been a free agency trend that we've seen with it's almost like a fantasy football draft with the number of guys who have just gone to teams over the course of a day or two. We've never seen anything like this. And a few teams have really stood out. So Bear, let's start with you. One team that has made a ton of moves off this offseason is the St. Louis Rams. Sam Bradford coming off of a great rookie year. There's a ton of talent that they're trying to put around him because he's clearly defined himself as a future star. What have the Rams done, and how do you think it'll help them this fall?
Well, they've gone out and they've really solidified their offensive unit, which was a problem at times last year. Offensive coordinator Pat Shurmur, who is now the head coach of the Browns, ran a very simple offense for Bradford, you know, given that, you know, he was a rookie and had limited experience running a pro-style offense. Rams general manager Billy Devaney really did a great job of targeting the weaknesses and, you know, by going out and getting Harvey Dahl, the right guard, signing a vertical wide receiver in Mike Sims-Walker, who has really had some great seasons down in Jacksonville.
Hey, you know, the Bear thing, one question I did have for you, by the way, was that how the heck was Mike Sims-Walker available in the free agent market? Why would the Jaguars let a guy that productive go? I mean, it's a great pickup for the Rams because Bradford badly needs someone who can catch a lot of passes from him. And if you're a fantasy football player, by the way, Mike Sims-Walker has number one or two receiver written all over him. But how was a guy like that even available?
He's had some injury concerns over the years, and he has a he has an image of being a guy like Randy Moss who will take plays off and doesn't necessarily give it his all. And down in Jacksonville with David Garrard, that's what people say about him is that once he leaves the football field, he's really not interested in football. And Sims Walker, I think, was really kind of given that same image alongside with Garrard, which possibly made it easier for the Jags to move on.
Well, the Jaguars have had a bad track record with their wide receivers, haven't they? Matt Jones and his cocaine habits in the parking lots. I mean, they've really got some issues, I guess, if Walker takes some time off. But if you put him in a productive environment and you let a quarterback like Sam Bradford, who, let's face it, I think we all can agree, is a significantly brighter prospect than David Garrard ever has been in his career, Mike Sims Walker could be a real game breaker for them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And the best part of it for the Rams is they were able to get him on a one-year deal. So if you have, if you're thinking about signing a player who lacks motivation, the best thing to do is to get him on a one-year deal and make him play for his pay. That seems to be something that Billy Devaney is really focusing on in free agency. He was able to do that with Cadillac Williams and also also with Sims Walker.
Well, those are two good pickups there. And living in Atlanta, I can tell you right now, the Harvey Dahl is just an absolute beast in the trenches. So you were talking about three players in offense there. There's only going to make Sam Bradford's life a lot easier. Rams squeaked in at the end of the year last season. But you know what? That's a team, I think, with a very bright future. But let's move away from the St. Louis Rams. Let's move on down to the East Coast. Let's talk about the Carolina Panthers. Let's bring in Robert Neely now. Robert, you've actually been going to training camp. And this is a team in the Panthers that made a lot of expensive signing right when free agency became available. A lot of it was their own players. Are the Panthers really going to be improved from last season? After all, they have the number one overall pick. And is Cam Newton going to see the field right away?
Cam Newton's going to see the field sooner than later. He's been pretty impressive in training camp. You see some problems with things like accuracy, with things like going through his progressions and getting to the third and fourth reads quickly. But he has undeniable physical talent and undeniable charisma. And really, that's what the Panthers are banking on, is that Newton can come in and really help at the quarterback position. They had such horrific quarterback play last year that was a big reason they fell to 2-14. And they're really banking on the fact that as Newton learns and gets ready to play, he can give them a little bit more stability at that position so that guys that they've re-signed like D'Angelo Williams, like keeping Steve Smith, even the defensive guys like the linebackers John Beeson, James Anderson, Thomas Davis, and defensive end Charles Johnson, that they can really pay off with those guys after getting better quarterback play to solve that big problem from last year.
Well, there's no question about it. I mean, they had Jimmy Clausen in as a starting quarterback, and I think anybody who saw Jimmy Clausen in college had to really question that pick. I mean, he's not exactly a leader of men. But another thing that's in the way of the Panthers heading into the season is they may be playing in the toughest division in the NFL. The Buccaneers, the Saints, the Falcons, they're all legitimate playoff contenders. What's a realistic expectation for the Panthers this fall?
I think the thing for the Panthers that I'm looking at is I think the first half of the season will be pretty rough. You're going to have a young quarterback in there, whether it's Clausen holding a place at the position or whether it's Newton kind of taking his lumps as a rookie. But I think if the Panthers can look at the second half of the season and see three or four wins out of the final eight, they can look at a sign of improvement and really think that, hey, we've got this thing pointing in the right direction and the 2012 could be a playoff campaign once again.
Well, it certainly looks like they're trying to make the 2011 season a springboard to a successful future. But one team where the future is now is in Philadelphia. Let's bring in Russell Baxter now. Russell, they may have the best three cornerbacks in recent memory of any team in the NFL. Is there any way that those three guys actually are there when the season begins?
Well, listen, when you have good players like the Eagles have right now, I think there's a tendency to think they're going to work a deal, and you never know what can happen. All of a sudden, somebody goes down, somebody's hurt, somebody's quickly out for the year, and suddenly down to two really good cornerbacks. So, the one thing I've always said and when it comes to things like this is depth is not only great, but if you have three good cornerbacks or any position where you're overly loaded at, that means the other 31 teams don't. And it's always a good way to play keep away. And unless you get a back-breaking deal that is, just knock somebody's socks off, you don't move these guys. Depth. I think depth this year because of the circumstances of the season, is going to be more important than it's ever been. And we know in this era of free agency that depth really doesn't exist anymore.
Well, that's absolutely the case. When you talk about injuries, let's face it, the Eagles' starting quarterback is Michael Vick. And his physical style of play, where, let's face it, he takes off and runs, he's been hurt a lot in his career. And now last season they had Kevin Cobb as a backup. When he was called to play, he played great. But you know what? Kevin Cobb's in Arizona now. Do we really think that – are people overestimating the Eagles' chances if Michael Vick goes down and Vince Young has to come in and play? Is he a viable backup right now?
Listen, I think the Eagles' hopes of getting to the Super Bowl this year don't necessarily rely on Michael Vick or even the offense. I think offensively they're pretty solid. Even if Vick would go down, I think Vince Young could come in there and certainly hold his own. They have – if you look at what the Eagles have done in free agency, and we don't necessarily have time to go through every name because it'd be easier to list who the Eagles didn't sign rather than who they did or did trade for. But look at it this way. On offense, they really added support people. I mean, LeSean McCoy led the team in rushing and receiving, and they brought in Ronnie Brown, who, by the way, can also throw a touchdown pass, as we saw him out of the Wildcat when he was with the Dolphins. Vince Young, obviously, is the backup to Michael Vick. Donald Lee, which is a signing that kind of goes under the radar for me, to back up Brent Celek. The offensive line, to me, it'll be interesting if Ryan Harris doesn't wind up with a starting job there somewhere down the road. You know, Winston Justice at right tackle has certainly had its problems. It's defensively that the Eagles have really fallen short the last couple of years. And I go all the way back to the NFC Championship game in 2008. And I know that was Donovan McNabb's fault because all he did was help put 25 points on the board. But remember, the Eagles were way down in that game, and they let Arizona march basically the length of the field to win that game, 32-25. Their defense has really been on the ropes the last couple of years. No team was worse in the red zone last year in terms of touchdown percentage. They were the easiest team to score on. They had their share of takeaways. They had their share of sacks, but you know, they still gave up a lot of points. And you look at some of these high-scoring games that the Eagles played in last year, that is the concern, and that's why they've remade their defense. They have a new defensive coordinator, and that's where I think if the Eagles are going to get to the Super Bowl, they're going to have to do it with major improvement on that side of the ball.
Great stuff there from Russell Baxter. You're not going to get much better analysis than the Philadelphia Eagles and their offseason moves anywhere else. But, guys, we've been talking about potential Super Bowl candidates here, but we're going to have to talk about a potential future Super Bowl site. And we're going to go back to Bear Heiser here. Bear, you're out in Los Angeles, and it's officially been approved that the NFL is going to have a team building a stadium in Los Angeles. But right now, we don't know who's going to be the tenant for this AIG project. So, Bear, tell us a little more about this project, and tell us, what do you think is going to happen to get a team there? Is it going to be an existing team, or is it going to be an expansion franchise?
Well, the groundwork has been laid. AIG has been granted all the approval they need to start building a stadium. All they need is just a team to commit to moving to L.A. And, from what I've been hearing out here in L.A., it will be a relocation. There will not be a new team brought in an expansion.
32 is a perfect number. There's no reason to expand is what their thought is, right?
Exactly. And if you're going to take a look at some of the teams that are out there that could move, and I know that you and I have talked about this before, the Chargers and the Rams, to me, are the likeliest options. All that needs to happen for AEG to break ground is for a team to commit by sometime next year. I don't have the exact date in front of me, but I know that the Chargers do have the ability to break their lease, and it will cost something around $24 million to break their lease down in San Diego. They have struggled. They've failed multiple times trying to get a new stadium built, and in California, trying to get public funding for a stadium is really difficult to do right now because the state's economy is so bad at the moment. And, you know, you look at the 49ers, the Raiders and the Chargers are all dealing with that. You know, the Raiders and the 49ers may have to partner together just to get a new stadium built. And that's something that Al Davis has not wanted to do up in Oakland. The Rams, they have, you know, they play in the Edward Jones Dome. I believe they can get out of their lease sometime around 2013 or 2014. And, you know, they've, you know, they've been in L.A. before. They still have a fan base out here. I think that they're a team that would be well received along with the Chargers, who have actually accelerated their marketing up here in L.A. 2 years ago, the Chargers partnered with the Wasserman Media Group, which is run by Casey Wasserman, who is also going to be a minority owner of the facility that AEG built here in L.A.
I think you're understating his role. He's probably been one of the big people behind making this deal happen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it was the Chargers that reached out to him that wanted his company to help promote the Chargers up here in L.A.
So the phrase we're looking here, Bear, is probably smart long-term planning on behalf of the Chargers. All right, well then there you go. Bear Heiser's local there. Let's go back to the East Coast. Let's talk to Robert again here. Robert, if you had to pick one team, aside from the teams that Bear just mentioned, heading out to Los Angeles to be that relocated team, who do you think it would be?
I think one obvious choice is the Minnesota Vikings, just because their stadium fell apart last season. And they also have their lease coming up, and they're in a municipality that's paid recently to have new stadiums, both for the Minnesota Twins baseball team and for the University of Minnesota for their football team. So you wonder if the funds are there to ante up again to build a stadium for a pro franchise. I don't think that Ziggy Wilf and his team want to move to L.A. I do think we'll hear noise about it as they try to negotiate the best deal they can in Minnesota.
Now, I remember when Ziggy Wilf came in as the owner, there was a lot of talk about him potentially moving the team to San Antonio. So, you know, this has kind of been a franchise in Minnesota who's kind of had a dalliance with moving ever since he took over. And I think there's something to be said about the concern from that. But on the flip side of the coin here, we're talking about a team in the Minnesota Vikings that's been there for 40-something years. Considering how long that the Vikings have been there in Minnesota, they're a traditional franchise. It's a big concern that maybe the NFL doesn't want them to move. But, you know, as Russell told us off air, no one ever would have thought that the Cleveland Browns would have left Cleveland. No one ever would have thought that the Indianapolis Colts would have left Baltimore. So you know what? In the end, money talks, and that is the bottom line. But you know what? This is the first sort of preview, if you will, of what's going to become the Writers' Roundtable here for NFA Radio on the NFL. It's going to come out every Wednesday with these three gentlemen. We have Bear Heiser. You can follow him on Twitter at Bear Heiser. We have Robert Neely. You can follow him on Twitter at Robert Neely, especially if you're a Panthers fan, because he's always at training camp. And we have Russell Baxter with us. He's at Bax Football Guru. And these three men will be with us next week when we do the first full-hour edition of the NFA Writers Roundtable on the National Football League. It's going to be great stuff, and you don't want to miss it. And one last thing, there is some great stuff coming out in National Football Authority this week. If you haven't caught it already, you don't want to miss it. Russell has an article coming out about game breakers in the National Football League. He's got six of the biggest home run threats in the NFL. You think you know them all? You'd be surprised. There's some names on there that you might not have thought of in the first place. It is stuff you do not want to miss. So make sure you don't miss it next week. National Football Authority Radio, it presents the NFA NFL Radio Hour. You don't want to miss it. And also, don't miss Russell's article. And after that, you know what's coming up next? We got some college football coming your way. We're bringing on Nate Custer. We're going to be talking about Notre Dame. We're going to be talking about the ACC. We're going to be talking about college football in general. So keep it locked. We'll be right back. We are back after a two-week hiatus. It is Nate and Bax on College Football. And, Nate, it has been far too long. We're joined by Nate Custer. Nate, how are you doing tonight?
Doing fantastic. You know, hey, we're getting closer to the season. How could you not be feeling good about that?
Yeah, seriously, hallelujah. Especially as somebody here who's an Ohio State alumnus and writes for Bucknuts and stuff. I am so happy the offseason from hell has come to an end and we actually have practice and football to talk about. It has been far too long of an offseason. And I can tell you there's probably about a half dozen other fan bases out there who feel the exact same way. So you know what? Let's start talking about some of these teams here. We've been doing some of our previews discussions over the last couple of weeks here. This week, one of the big ones dropped. Notre Dame, one of the traditional powerhouses. And that was a preview that came out this Monday at NationalFootballAuthority.com. Nate, What do you think of Brian Kelly and the job he's done at Notre Dame thus far?
You know what? Actually, I'm really impressed. And people can say that it was a down year for them again last year. But if you look at what Brian Kelly's establishing for the Domers, they're going to be very excited in the next few years. So if you look, yeah, he didn't get the BCS bowl game like in his first year like other, you know, his predecessors have. But Brian Kelly is the guy that's going to reestablish Notre Dame as a household brand in the world of college football. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I think if anybody from the Notre Dame side of things was unhappy with last year, they're simply unrealistic. Notre Dame finally beat USC. Notre Dame closed really well down the stretch. I mean, they kicked Utah's butt and turned that into a great closing stretch where, by the way, they beat Miami handily in a bowl game. Brian Kelly absolutely has that program going the right way. And if look at the recruiting class he brought in. I don't know if there's ever been a Notre Dame recruiting class that goes all around the country like that and brings in not one, not two, but 3 5-star D linemen. This guy was the right end for this job from the second they hired him. He's an Irish guy named Kelly. Let's be honest here. I mean, he is perfect. The epitome of Notre Dame. Yeah, I mean, he's perfect for this role. And I tell you what, right now, Notre Dame's record would have been even better last year if they hadn't had to deal with all the injuries they had at quarterback. I'm excited to see what they're going to do this year.
I'm a Dane Crist fan. I like what, you know, will happen there. I don't know if he's going to have the stable of quarterbacks like he did at Cincinnati. And you know what? I will actually admit that I was wrong. I didn't think that Kelly was the right guy for this job. After seeing what he did last year and how well he's run the team, I'm willing to admit I was wrong. I have totally been proven wrong by this guy. I think the next couple of years, we're really going to see that reestablishment of Notre Dame as a real powerhouse in college football. Back to the BCS. It's on its way. I was totally wrong, and I'm willing to admit it.
Well, that's big of you. I, on the other hand, will gloat because I totally called this. This is a guy who was a winner, though, at Central Michigan. This is a guy who was a winner in Division II football at Grand Valley State.
He won the national championship. His defenses were never good, in my opinion, you know, looking at this stuff. And he's an offensive guy, but looking at what he's doing, like you mentioned, the 5-star recruits, 3 of them coming on the D-line. I mean, the guy's focusing heavily on his defense, and you know he's got the offense in check, so why not focus on the defense? So I'm impressed.
Absolutely. I think he got a little bit of a bum rap on his defenses when he was at Cincinnati, because a lot of those years he only had 1 or 2 or 3 returning starters. He's had the same coaching staff go with him at every location, and they've done a pretty decent job. And granted, some of those defenses at Cincinnati were hot garbage, but you know what? Brian Kelly, when you're the head coach, you can fiddle with those things a little bit. Brian Kelly has the culture going at Notre Dame. The administrators believe in him. They're letting him bring in players that Notre Dame before this wouldn't have let bring in. I mean, 10 years ago, Michael Floyd would not be playing this fall for Notre Dame. He would have been thrown out of school for his DUI. It's a completely different era at Notre Dame. And I think they realize they need to sort of get with the times if they want to become relevant in football. And aside from worshiping the Lord in heaven, football is number one on campus at Notre Dame. They finally realize this is what they have to do to make it work.
Hey, I'm a Catholic guy, so for me this works. I like what's happening in Notre Dame. At the same time, I don't know that I support the decision with Floyd, but at the same time, I get that, you know, maybe this goes beyond just the important role that he plays, and maybe they are trying to help him as a person. I don't know. I hope that's the case, but I do think that some standards kind of fell because Notre Dame is that hungry to get to the next level again. So I question the decision to have Floyd as a member of this team and not to be held back on a single game. I question that, but hey, I'm not the head coach, nor am I the chancellor in charge of the university. So up to them.
Yeah, I'm a little more cynical than you here. I 100% believe if Michael Floyd wasn't a 1,000-yard, 80-catch type receiver, he would have been booted. But, you know, that's just me. Let's ask the most pertinent question, though. After a great first year from Notre Dame, developing, getting better over the course of the year, and bringing in a ton of great recruits, does Notre Dame make the BCS this year?
You know what? I think I'm going to say no this year, but I'm not going to rule it out as a possibility. I know that's a really wishy-washy answer, but if my gut tells me not this year, but I won't be surprised if they make it. But I would, if I were predicting, I'd say not this year.
You know, my initial thought with Notre Dame this year was I figured about 9-3 would be their record. Yeah. But on the flip side of the coin here, you look at the BCS, there's 10 spots available. If you look at the Big Ten, the Pac-12, they both have championship games now. It's going to be harder for both those leagues to send a second team. And if you look at the BCS busters that we've had the last couple of years, there's not necessarily going to be 2 every year like we saw. So you know what? A 9-3 Notre Dame team.
It's possible.
If they're in the top 12, somebody will take them to be in the BCS. So
I'm guessing 8-4, but 9-3, if they hit 9-3, they'll be very hard to overlook for the BCS, especially when you look at how much money is involved in taking them to BCS game. And hey, I wish the Irish luck. I'm good with it. I'm guessing an 8-4 record, but if it's 9-3, I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm not against Notre Dame. A lot of people hate on them, but I root for every traditional program to get back and have success aside from the University of Michigan. So we're gonna close things out on Notre Dame there. But let's talk about a conference that hasn't really traditionally had a lot of success. This is the next preview that'll be dropping on NationalFootballAuthority.com. It's the ACC conference, and you know, a couple years ago when they expanded, everybody was expecting the new SEC, a new powerhouse, Miami versus Florida State in the championship game every year. And both those teams have kind of fallen flat the last couple of years. Virginia Tech has dominated that conference.
Yes.
Is this the year that we really see those two Florida schools finally make a return to the elite in college football?
Florida State, yes. Miami, not yet. Miami is going to be making strides in that direction, but they are not the same teams that they were, say, 10 years ago. Florida State, I'm a Jimbo Fisher fan. I like what Jimbo's doing. I'm impressed. I especially love the recruiting. I like what's going on there at Florida State. I hate what happened to Bobby Bowden, but I also understand why they made the move. I get it. It makes sense. But at the same time, Florida State, with the level of recruiting it's had, they are primed and ready to make an impact this year. Miami, no one to overlook, but they're not the powerhouse they used to be, especially not from the early 90s, the early 2000s. It's not the same team, and it won't be for a little bit of time.
No, I agree with you there on Miami. They got some talent, but until a turnover machine Ja'Cory Harris isn't starting a quarterback, they're not going to break Aiton Warrior.
Get a solid quarterback. I don't understand how they haven't made that such a priority. I just don't understand it. Love what, you know, the weapons that Miami has to work with. They always do a great job, and especially when you're looking at defenses, they have some really amazing athletic talented guys there. But get yourself a quarterback and build around it.
You know what, though? I do trust Al Golden. Right? He achieved the impossible of making Temple respectable. So you know, don't overlook this guy. Al Golden knows what he's doing. I wouldn't be surprised to see Miami have a very good season and be competitive in their division, but I think Virginia Tech's still the team to beat in the Coastal. As for Florida State, I have 100% bought into this team. They are a top five preseason team in my book. And you know, one thing that really catches my eye about this is that this is kind of a throwback to Florida State whenever they were on that 14-year streak of top five finishes. Yeah. And if you look at quarterback, EJ Manuel, he's a junior stepping into the starting lineup, right?
I like it.
But he has a lot of key experience. He played in the Gator Bowl in Bowden's last game. He played very well last year in the ACC title game. Maybe it's his first year starting, but he's a very experienced junior. He's stepping into a lineup where there's a lot of weapons around him and a damn good offensive line in front of him. So you know what? Florida State, I think, is the team to beat in the ACC. And honestly, this is the first time I can probably say this in a decade, but I think Florida State's a national title contender.
You're preaching the choir. I am absolutely impressed with EJ Manuel.
Yeah, I think Florida State, honestly, is the team to beat in the ACC. Now, I'm not going to count out Virginia Tech, though. They're kind of the third team in the Big Three this year in the ACC because I don't know if you agree with me on this one, but I think the rest of the ACC is average to mediocre at best this year, kind of like in past years with the ACC. And I tell you right now, Virginia Tech, their quarterback, I mean, Thomas is stepping in, and he is a physical clone of Terrell Pryor. He's a physical clone of Cam Newton. I'm not going to say he's going to have as much success as those two did in college right off the bat, but it wouldn't shock me whatsoever.
Recruited as a tight end, you know, making the impact after, you know, folks saw him throwing the ball around. They're like, I think we've got this kid in the wrong position, and I think they're right. And you know what? When I look at the Virginia Tech Hokies, I'm a big fan of Beamer Ball. I love the emphasis he puts on special teams. I mean, that's because I'm out here in Boise. I watch what Boise State does with their special teams. They learned that from Frank Beamer. He's the guy who made special teams such a big deal. Don't just hold special teams for your less impactful players. Put your best guys in the positions where they can make the most impact. And Frank Beamer gets that. And he always has a great philosophy on, you know, the running game. I mean, it works for them. Putting a guy at quarterback like they've got coming in, Logan, I mean, this guy's going to be amazing to watch, and I can't wait for it. And I never count out Virginia Tech. They have been the power that's been established back in there ever since the weakening of Florida State in Miami. Virginia Tech is someone that you cannot overlook, but I do believe you are correct. I'm with you on this. You're preaching to the choir that Florida State is the team to beat in the ACC for the overall championship.
Well, you know what? Virginia Tech for the last 7 years has won the ACC title. The one yep. time they went to the ACC title game and didn't win, Florida State beat them. I have to say right now, as good as I think Virginia Tech's going to be, Virginia Tech is a team I will never pick to win a national title because they always lose a game or two they shouldn't, like we saw last year with James Madison. Florida yes. State on the other side of the coin. Oklahoma comes to town on September 17th. That's the biggest non-conf game of the year, in my opinion. Yeah. That's going to be an awesome game because, let's face it, Oklahoma is a lot of people's prohibitive favorite to win the national title.
They're mine. They're mine.
Like you said, preaching to the choir. I mean, this I don't remember this consensus of a number one team since probably going back to Florida a few years would be my best guess is the last time a team was this well thought of compared to Oklahoma. But you know what? Florida State is revenge on their mind because Oklahoma actually should have lacked them last year in Norman. And if Florida State wins that game over Oklahoma, I think they jump to number one in the polls right then and there. And from there, Florida State does not have that hard of a conference schedule. Let's face it, their next difficult game would be Miami. And then after that, it's Florida and on to the ACC title game. And they have a very smooth sailing ahead of them. I'm picking Florida State to win the ACC. I'm not picking them to beat Oklahoma, though.
Well, here's the thing. I'm with you. I think Oklahoma wins this ball game, but I think it's going to be tight. But even if Florida State beats Oklahoma, the preseason number one, I don't think that pushes them to number one. I would say Alabama holds on to that. There's too many people that are in support of Alabama, and they'd say, like, well, it was the preseason. What did we know? You know, I get where you're saying
the
with that.
SEC
that gives them
too.
Yeah, I just don't think that the team from the ACC, whoever's the hot hand at that time, is going to have enough clout to be able to push that number one ranking. I don't think it's going to happen. I think Alabama would still stay number two, or excuse me, would jump up from number two to number one.
Well, we'll have to see because, you know, if Alabama goes out and has another fairly unimpressive win over Penn State like the one they had last year, I wouldn't be surprised that if it's Florida State, one of those names that moves the needle that everybody gets excited about, I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but, you know, it's a possibility, and that's so much better than Florida State's been able to say for a decade. So I think Seminole fans right now will take it, win or lose, over Oklahoma.
All right.
Well, you know what? One other thing, Nate, here. Let's move away from the ACC. You mentioned a few moments ago you're out in Boise. Can you explain to me what the heck is going on with them firing their athletic director this week?
I am absolutely shocked by this. It was breaking news, and not necessarily now at this point when this podcast is playing, but Boise State President Dr. Bob Custra announced that he had let go Gene Blamire, who had been with Boise State the full-time athletics director as of 1982. We're talking nearly 30 years. He's been with the university for over 30.
That's like Joe Paterno length, you know?
It's unbelievable. Blamire is largely responsible for a great many of the successes of Boise State emerging as a bona fide powerhouse in football. While many from the SEC or the Big 12 may not think they are a big-time football team, in the last few years, they're consistently ranked in the top 10. That, to me, says they have made the move, and Gene Blamire is a big reason why that's happened. Actually, President Custra delivered the announcement on Wednesday evening that he had let him go, and actually said this. I quote, and I'm getting this from the Idaho Statesman, said, "I did not come to this decision lightly. After a careful management review and discussions about the future of the program, I determined that new leadership will be needed as we commit ourselves to the highest level of attention and enforcement of NCAA standards and also continue to move Boise State athletics to the next level of success." It's because of the NCAA sanctions that were going on there. They're worried about the sanctions they'll get from the NCAA. To me, not knowing if there's anything more than what we already know about this, this is a knee-jerk response that is entirely unnecessary and ill-advised, in my opinion.
So it sounds like it's a fearful response of saying we're so close to officially making ourselves established, guaranteed, not going anywhere as a premier program in the country. And if NCAA sanctions come down, that may affect us. So I'm going to pull the plug on the godfather of the Smurf turf. To me, this sounds like an absolute knee-jerk reaction, Nate, but I want to get one other opinion from you here. If this is how quick he pulls the plug on the athletic director, how does this affect Chris Peterson and his relationship with Boise?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because following a football season of Chris Peterson leaving, 2011 is it. This is the one. And the draw of the Stanford job, it would have taken him back close to where he's from, Northern California. But if there's any issues with Oregon, let's say all hell breaks loose and Oregon decides that they're going to get through this season, but then they're going to find a new coach if things go horrible for Chip Kelly in involvement with any potential problems with the NCAA based off of all the recruiting issues that have been brought up for the last several months. If that position is open, and if Peterson, having many of his seniors on this team leaving the program, namely Kellen Moore, and there's like 25 seniors on this team.
Yeah, it's a there's huge a lot senior of kids. Class.
Exactly. They're all leaving. This is something where I wouldn't be surprised to see Coach Peterson say, maybe it's time to move. Maybe it's time to look elsewhere. Peterson, what Peterson wants at Boise State, Peterson gets. He doesn't, you know, this is not someone who has to answer to really anybody. He does have bosses in the athletics director and the president, but let's be real about this. They are trying to hold on to him. And Gene Blamire and he had a really good relationship. You get rid of the athletics director who basically made things work the way Pete wanted them. Now that that's gone, you better make damn sure you find the right guy to replace him that Pete's happy about if you want to maintain him here at Boise State. So if there's any colleges out there, any university programs that want to make a play for Pete, 2011 after the season's done, this is the time to make that play.
Well, you know, his name has came up in rumors all over the place, from places as close as Oregon to places as far away as Penn State as an eventual potential successor for Joe Pa. If you're a Boise State fan right now, you got to be very concerned. And I'll say that, to say one more thing about this, Nate, is that I think this is another example of these stupid NCAA regulations that the presidents came out today and said they want to get rid of all these nuisance rules, these things that nobody really cares about. Thank God it's a great decision. But this is costing a lot of people jobs. For example, Gene Blamire, or situations that are frankly quite silly. I mean, a kid sleeping on the floor and getting free pizza, and that's an NCAA violation? Are you kidding
me?
Yeah,
I know.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
And here's the thing. Boise State folks are probably pretty perturbed about this whole thing. I mean, they dubbed that the blue turf was Gene Blamire's decision, and it was his idea, and they installed it in 86. Well, they call that Lake Blamire. I mean, it's the blue, but it's been dubbed Lake Blamire. It's what he built there at Boise State. He turned that into an iconic symbol of college football. Is it one that everyone loves? Probably not. But he did things his own way, and he made things work at Boise State and brought them up to relevance. Not just there, they're relevant now. And to get rid of that guy, I'm astounded and shocked, and I cannot believe they chose to do this. There better be a good reason for it. But from what we all know about this whole thing, I'm surprised by it. And it's a bad move, in my opinion.
Well, if nothing else comes out, I agree with you. It is definitely a bad move. But speaking of moves, there's one other topic I want to bring up with you. And this has been a hot-button topic the last few days here. Let's go back to the summer of 2010 when the expansion shenanigans were going on. Nebraska leaving for the Big Ten. Colorado going to the Pac-12. Boise State moving to the Mountain West. The biggest domino that didn't fall was Texas, Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, Texas A&M, all invited to the PAC, what would have been 16. Yeah. Well, the last few days, it's popped up that Texas A&M is in negotiations with the SEC. There was a lot of rumors. Paul Feinbaum, who has the ridiculous football show in Alabama going on that I've probably ever seen anywhere else. Feinbaum is he's a character, but he had had people on repeatedly talking about this. And Nate, let's face it here. There may have never have been a bigger hot button topic the last few years, even with all the NCAA sanctions we've dealt with. Of things that make people talk, expansion is probably the biggest one. And Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, a former Texas A&M Yell leader, a guy who might be the next president of this country, comes out and says, yeah, there's talks going on. Well, I'm going to believe that guy. What do you think could happen here? Is this something that's imminent right now with Texas A&M going to the SEC? And what does that mean for college football at large?
Absolutely. And it will create, you know, college football landscape shakeup 2.0 from what we saw last year. And it could be more far-reaching this time around. Let's face it. Texas pretty much wants to be independent, so why not let them go independent? I don't care about it. Fine, go for it. But you're going to have teams like Texas A&M. I think they're a great fit for the SEC, and how would the SEC not want to add a team like Texas A&M into the fold, or Oklahoma? Those two will want to be there, but the problem with Oklahoma is where Oklahoma goes, you probably have to take Oklahoma State with you. So
T.B.
how
Pickens
that shakes
will make
down.
That happen.
Yeah, he's got enough money to make it happen, so why not? So we'll have to see how that shakes down, but you will see the SEC as being the first 16-team conference. This bodes well for conferences like the Mountain West, for the Pac-12. They could achieve their 16-team league if the SEC does it. Then you know the Big Ten's looking at options. Heck, you could see Texas going to the Big Ten if the deal is right. You know,
Absolutely. Was it two summers ago? The email came out. The Texas president was talking with E. Gordon Gies, the president of Ohio State, and Jim Delaney.
Not?
No, I agree with you completely. Why not? Texas, in many ways, sees itself as a Big Ten type of institution. They're the flagship for their state. They're above average academically. They're a huge football school. That wouldn't shock me. Honestly, I think Texas is more likely to join the Big Ten than they are to go independent, because they know if the 16-team Super Conference structure comes to be, if you're an independent on the outside, you're not as likely to get into a championship picture. Because if we have four 16-team Super Conferences, my personal belief is that we're going to see the winner of each of those conferences put into a 14 playoff for the national championship. And Texas absolutely positively does not want left out from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like what this means for certain conferences like the Mountain West. I love watching some of the non-AQs. Not all, but some. And the Mountain West is one of them I like to watch. And so I think it'd be fun to see if some, you know, maybe a Kansas or Kansas State or wind up joining with the Mountain West. Because there are going to be some schools that will get left out in the cold because there's not enough room in the Pac-12 to become the Pac-16. Four spots, you know, four more spots in the SEC for a 16-team league and four spots in the Big Ten. So who knows what happens, but I think we're on the verge, and it seems like this is imminent. The very deal that solved the problem of the Big 12 falling apart last year is the same thing that could definitely cause its demise. That
it was such a flawed deal.
Yeah, and I don't blame Texas A&M for moving forward at all. Yeah.
Oh, no, Texas A&M has all the right in the world because they know it's going to make them a second-class citizen in their own state. And let's face it, this is a state where if you break up the alumni. A&M is a huge school. And, okay, they've been largely mediocre the last decade. But they're still the second biggest school in the state of Texas. They are still a traditional football power. They have an 85,000-seat stadium. They have a huge alumni base in the fastest-growing state in the country. There's plain and simple. Texas A&M is an utter coup for the SEC because if the SEC gets them, all of a sudden all the SEC schools can go into Texas and recruit and say, you can play a home game against Texas A&M.
Absolutely.
It's that simple. It's that simple. But I tell you right here, though, the other thing that really stands out to me is that if the 16-team Super Conferences happen, that's when Notre Dame, who we mentioned earlier, that's when their independence officially ends. Jack Swarbrick is their AD. He said that last year. He's like, we want to stay independent unless it becomes obvious that that's the way that the entire country is going. We're not going to get left behind. Notre Dame's going to join the Big Ten. It's not a matter of if. It's a matter of when.
It's where they fit.
Oh, absolutely. They're a Big Ten institution in a lot of ways. Yeah. And, you know, I think, though, if it ends up happening like this, if Texas A&M is the first domino to the SEC, I think you're going to see the ACC rated by the SEC and by the Big Ten. Because in a 16-team situation for the Big Ten, I think they obviously take Notre Dame. I think Missouri, from a failing Big 12, comes flying to the Big Ten, and the Big Ten will let them in as soon as they get Notre Dame. Missouri is an unbelievably good addition for the Big Ten in terms of the Big Ten network because that gives them the Kansas City market and the St. Louis market where they can charge a higher number for their channel.
Yeah, I didn't get why they left them out when they were talking to Nebraska. I didn't understand that. You know, I mean, I understand you're looking at the dynamics of everything and how many teams you can permit, but it seems like they were never really that serious about Missouri when they knew they could get Nebraska. And I get that Nebraska's a good get, but overall, regional-wise and market value-wise, Missouri makes a lot of sense.
You know, I think the Big Ten made this move to get to 12 with Nebraska to put even competition level on the football field with the SEC. I think they say if the SEC is a 12-team league, well, our 12-team league with Nebraska is just as good on paper, which, you know, you can make that argument. I understand that. But if it goes to the point where they're growing the conferences, the Big Ten is going to expand for the TV bucks because the Big Ten network, or in the Big Ten footprint, it makes 80 cents a subscriber roughly right now. Outside of that, it makes 10 cents or 20 cents. What happens all of a sudden if you add Notre Dame, you add Missouri with the St. Louis and Kansas City markets, you add a Maryland where you can add Washington and D.C. and Baltimore into there, and you add Rutgers, you got the state of New Jersey, you got New York City, the Big Ten network. I wrote an article for this actually on Bucknuts.com not that long ago. It could be worth as much as $200 million a year to the Big Ten to add those four schools just through the Big Ten network because of the size of the market that they're in. And that for the Big Ten is an unbelievable game changer. So while you might see teams like the SEC reach for football schools like Texas A&M, maybe they go for Clemson or Florida State, the Big Ten is going to get their football school in Notre Dame. Missouri is not a bad choice. Maryland and Rutgers, let's face it, football-wise, they're not that great. Market-wise, future growth-wise, they're killer. And that's why the Big Ten is going to go after them.
Well, and I think the ACC is going to get raided if that happens because if Texas, you know, screws everything up and Texas A&M goes the SEC, you know, Miami's be knock on the door. You know, Florida State's knock on the door. Clemson makes a lot of sense to me. I always think of them as an SEC school, even though they're not even that much of a power in the ACC. I just tend to think of them as that regional fit.
Their mindset's very much an SEC school. There's no question about it. Their biggest rivals are South Carolina and Georgia. So,
yeah. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if the ACC got raided here. I tell you, I don't think Miami's going, though, because I don't think Miami has any of the fan base, any of the real major market value that the SEC is going to be looking for. And plus, I don't think Florida's going to be happy if they take both Florida State and Miami. I think Florida State's a stronger possibility than Miami.
Clemson, absolutely.
Like you said, one team I don't think you're going to see go to the SEC is going to be Virginia Tech, though. I know a lot of people down here in SEC country want to add Virginia Tech, but they're not going anywhere without Virginia. And Virginia is not joining the SEC, period.
They're terrible. No, no.
No, they're terrible. Definitely. And their academics, they look at it. They say, well, we'd be the smartest school in the SEC aside from Vanderbilt. What do we want from that? Let's face it, the SEC, their fans don't want to hear it, but their schools aren't academically that strong. They're not the Big Ten. They're not Texas. They're not the Pac-12. I'm sorry, it's the truth. They're not the ACC. And Virginia is going to look at it and say, no, 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 I don't want to be associated academically. And the dirty little secret here is that academics are almost as lucrative to these universities, if not more so, with their research dollars than the television dollars that come with major football. So there's so many variables going on here, Nate. But bottom line, I think A&M's going to the SEC, and I think it's going to be sooner rather than later. What's your final word on it?
Bottom line for me, I think you're right on A&M going to the SEC, and bottom line overall, the almighty dollar rules, and they don't want to be underneath the thumb of Texas anymore. This is a done deal as far as I'm concerned.
Super conferences, here they come. All right, well, that was Nate Custer. I am Matt Bax. Now, this is Bax and Nate on College Football. I'd like to thank each and every one of you for listening in. Nate, thank you very much for coming on. We look forward to having you back next week, sir. And don't forget to check out our college football previews. Notre Dame came out this Monday. The ACC is coming out soon. And next week, Big 12. We got the Pac-12, not the Pac-10 anymore, the Pac-12. Those are dropping. And, of course, after that, it's the Big Ten in the SEC. You don't want to miss it on NationalFootballAuthority.com. Nate, thank you so much for coming on tonight.
You got it. Thanks for having me, Bax.
Well, that's all the time we have today here on National Football Authority Radio. I'd like to thank Nate Custer. I'd like to thank Bear Heiser. I'd like to thank Robert Neely and Russell Baxter for coming on the show this week. And like I told you all earlier in the show, next week we're going to have two shows. Wednesday is when we're going to have the NFA Radio, NFL Writers Roundtable. You won't want to miss it. That segment we had earlier in the show is just a tease. It's going to be a lot more of that high-quality talk about the National Football League. Don't miss it. And of course, we're going to be bringing Nate back because it's Bax and Nate on football every week. And of course, that's going to be our second show. We're splitting off the NFL and college football as we approach the season into two separate podcasts. But this week on NationalFootballAuthority.com, you don't want to miss Russell Baxter's article on game breakers in the National Football League, who are the biggest six in the entire NFL. I tell you what, one of them plays for my Pittsburgh Steeler, and I'm really glad that he included him. And, of course, we have our college football previews. Notre Dame came out on Monday. The ACC is coming out soon. And next week's the Big 12 and the Pac-12. So for all of us here at National Football Authority, I'd like to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And we'll see you next week, twice. See ya!